Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Do you believe in the devil, like as the supreme dark energy? Thanks for coming on with us, sir.
Well, you bet. Where are you all based?
We're in Scottsdale, Arizona.
Via New York City. We lived in New York for almost 20 years. So we got out of New York and, settled here in Scottsdale.
Well, great. That's a nice place to be.
Yeah, it's about 90 degrees already.
Whoa.
And are you in North Carolina?
We're actually in Virginia.
Oh, okay.
Outside of Charlottesville.
Okay.
So about a 2.5 hour drive southwest of DC towards the mountains.
Oh, nice. Awesome. Beautiful.
Yeah, we're really excited to have you. I mean, so to start this off, so in 2016, my father died, and that's when I started to go on a little bit of a journey because I was just struggling with and dealing with his death. And so your story was in 2008. My father died in 2016. And
unexpectedly.
Unexpectedly. It was like a big shocker to our family. And it caught us all off guard. And so, like, I hadn't heard of you until that point when I just I had a very surreal dream one night. And then that really, like, started me on this journey, you know, going down the YouTube rabbit hole. And I found one of your videos. It was like one of your talks. It was like an hour and a half. I listened to the whole thing. And I was like, wow, this is incredible.
I knew who you were already.
Did your homework. That's great.
Yeah, 100%.
Now, when you say surreal dream, did your father appear to you in the dream?
Yes, that's what we wanted to talk
exactly.
to. Yes.
Yeah, he came in my dream. He was like, I saw him as what he was as a younger, like, because he was a Marine.
Excellent.
He was a Marine, and I saw him with his, like, you know, had his shorter mustache and his military, like, green t-shirt on, his fatigues.
And they're going up an escalator, and he was like going one way and Pierre was going down, and then all of a sudden they were on the same.
And then it was escalator. Like he was going up the escalator, and I was like, that's my dad. And then next thing I know, I'm hugging him with the most realistic hug. I mean, I could smell him, I could feel him.
Crazy.
I woke up because I cried literally like 2 weeks after my dad died, but I cried. I was crying when I woke up. I was like, that was the most realistic dream I've ever had. I never remember my dreams, you know? That set me off on this journey, just like looking up stuff. I did get it. I did listen to a few like binaural beats. I didn't really get anything from that afterwards, but I was like, wow, that was really amazing. And that kind of took me into that. But your story really like struck out. We actually, which is crazy is, We got your I actually finally read your book because I've listened to all your stuff on the internet, but then we got Proof of Heaven probably like this year. It was like eight months ago,
and we were just searching. We were in Barnes and Noble, so we're just kind of opening up here with our own stuff because we're going to let you dive right in. But we were looking, and we're Catholic, and we're very intrigued with, like, you know, especially after his father's passing, and then my mother also, like, she had people come to her before they pass. It's just like this weird like connection and departing. Mm-hmm. And so we were just kind of intrigued in your book, and I was like, I knew this guy. I mean, I've seen him on Oprah. I know him. So we read it. He's a firefighter. He read it at the fire station. Then it was my turn to read it. And here you are. And we just were so excited when you decided to join us, because to have you here and to talk about like what we've experienced and what you experienced is just a blessing. So
yeah, absolutely.
Good. We should get into all of that.
Let's go. Yeah.
Yes, sir. So you had an extraordinary experience. You had meningitis. It attacked your brain, and you were in a coma. Uh-huh. And then you also had amnesia from that experience as well. And you've had many case studies and stuff and people verifying that, yeah, his brain was in fact not functioning, right? And you had these amazing, and you're one of the most articulate people on this subject. So we'd just like to let you go ahead and bless, like, how
right,
did...
Now, right. And it's, I think it's important to point out, at that time, this all happened in November 2008. Mm-hmm. I was 54 years old. I had spent more than 15 years teaching neurosurgery at Harvard Medical School, thought I had some idea of how brain, mind, and consciousness work. But important to point out to the listening audience that I had been trained, like so many of us trained in science in the 20th and early 21st century, in what's known as materialism or physicalism. That's the notion that only the physical world exists. And so if you understand, you know, the physics of the particles and all that, then you will end up understanding that world completely.
Yeah.
And the problem is materialism has never done anything to help us understand consciousness. In fact, hardcore materialist scientists will tell you we have no free will at all, given that it's all chemical reactions going on in the brain and an illusion of consciousness. And the thing is, they have it completely backwards, because the only thing that really exists is our consciousness. And that's something we share.
Yeah.
And there's a connection of information that goes beyond the physical world. And that's where all this is leading. But back in November 2008, I subscribed fully to that kind of Newtonian deterministic model of physical reality. And I was soon to find out that that model doesn't work.
Yeah.
And so what happened was severe headaches, severe back pain.
Yeah.
And then I went into grand mal seizures. And now there's a one of the reporters on my story out there who was basically trying to destroy my credibility.
We read about her.
Claimed that this was a medically induced coma.
She said that.
And that is not the case. Yeah. It was induced by meningitis. In fact, I was on... went into deep coma without any sedation at all. And I was on very heavy sedation at the end of that week when I came out of coma. So sedation, you throw out the window. And that's why my case, I think, is so important to the medical community.
Yeah.
Because the documented damage to my neocortex was so extensive, not just what I talk about in Book Proof of Heaven, but in a medical case report on my medical records that came out in September 2018 in the Journal of Nervous and Mental Disease. And it was by doctors Serbi Khanna, Lauren Moore, and Bruce Grayson. And that case report made it very clear my brain was in terrible shape. The entire neocortex was under attack. And anyone who reads that will realize that, you know, I would not have any chance of having a dream or hallucination with a brain that impaired.
Yeah.
And where in the world did this incredible experience that I ended up having, where did that come from? And how did it happen at a time when my brain was demonstrably offline? Now, another important thing, part of the backstory of that medical case report, is that the peer review editors, the scientific editors of the journal, said, oh, wait a minute, how do you explain this case? It's unprecedented in the medical literature for someone that ill with bacterial meningoencephalitis involving all lobes of the brain, coma for a week, to then end up having a complete return over, you know, 2 months post-coma. How did that happen? And they said it's because he had a near-death experience.
Wow.
That was the key. So that was our kind of scientific explanation. And that's a very important statement.
Yeah.
Because materialist scientists have been trying to peg these things on the atoms and molecules and substance of the brain. And yet the evidence is all over the place that our conscious awareness is not ultimately created by the brain, but is filtered in by the brain. That's very different. And in fact, long-term memories are not stored in the brain. So that's kind of where we're going with all this. But I'll now briefly get into, you know, what I went through back in November 2008. Because that's where, you know, the excitement builds about what this is actually telling us about the nature of reality.
Yeah.
So from that state of severe headache and then going into coma, important to point out one of the atypical features of my...
Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
My near-death experience was the fact that I was amnesic. I had no memory of Evan Alexander's life, no memory of Earth, humans, this universe. It really was an empty slate.
Wow.
And it took me months, if not years, after my coma to really kind of figure out why that was the case.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I mean, NDEs are always tailored absolutely for the individual who has them. They have no other existence in the universe, except when you study them scientifically in large groups, you find tremendous overlap and kind of correlation between these journeys that show us it's a real realm. It's not some imaginary dream world, but this is absolutely a realm that's in many ways much more real than this one. And that's what I was about to encounter. It started for me in this very amnesic state in what I call the earthworm eye view, very primitive, coarse, kind of unresponsive realm. It was like being in dirty jello. And I had no memories of my life. I had no body awareness at all. I was simply a speck of awareness, of existence, an observer. And what I've witnessed was just this kind of dark, foreboding underground world. But the good news is I was rescued by this slowly spinning white light that came towards me, packaged with a perfect musical melody. And that white light opened up like a rip in the fabric of this ugly earthworm eye view realm and led me up into this brilliant ultra real gateway valley.
Wow.
Now, this is where things get pretty much indescribable. You've often heard that these journeys are ineffable. They're beyond our language. Mm-hmm. You know, our words are pretty good for describing a trip to Disney World. They're not quite so good for this kind of extraordinary spiritual journey. And one of the things that makes it so difficult is when you're in that realm, you're actually in a timeless realm. It's a realm of eternity and where you can see all the events of your life, birth, death, everything in between, past lives, future life, potential, et cetera. Every bit of that is manifested simultaneously for you. And so much of the interconnections and reasons for things happening and deeper causes connecting all these events become apparent. And that's one of the things that's just so shocking. Now, in my case, I was not to have an Evan Alexander life review because of the amnesia, but I was able to witness life reviews and reincarnation in very powerful fashion. And I often point out to people that even though your prior religious beliefs might influence how you narrate the story, they don't influence the content. And you often have people coming back, and this can include atheists and agnostics, what have you, whose kind of spiritual beliefs are radically altered by this kind of journey in a very positive way. That's one of the things that's so impressive to psychiatrists and other physicians who care for people, is they realize that the amount of healing and transformation that comes from a near-death experience goes far beyond anything we've ever been able to accomplish with any kind of medical treatment or intervention. So it's kind of a self-healing way, but it has to do with discovering more about who we truly are, our grander sense of self, far beyond the little ego voice. I love how Michael Singer in his book, The Untethered Soul, he calls that voice in your head your annoying roommate. That voice in your head is not your consciousness. Your consciousness is your awareness of that. And that awareness can be far richer and wiser than the simple thought machine of our little linguistic brain and our ego mind. And this is why I encourage people, meditation, centering prayer. These are the ways to come into a fuller knowing of this connection with the mind of the universe, with that God mind. And we can talk about that a little later because I have a very specific technique. Sacredacoustics.com is what I use for meditation. But the reality is, in this deep coma experience, in that gateway valley, I mean, it was a kind of a shocking reality. It makes this world look very much like a dream state.
Interesting.
That world is dark, crisp, alive, real, detailed, transformational. And when people have these experiences, what you find is 20 years later, the memories of the experience are still there, unchanged from what they were when they first happened. These memories are much more like real lived events and very impressively lived events. That's why people remember them so well.
Yeah.
Now, in this beautiful Gateway Valley, I was a speck of awareness on a butterfly wing. There are millions of other butterflies looping and spiraling in vast formations. And below us in this meadow were thousands of beings dancing. Mm. Lots of joy and merriment. I even remember seeing children playing and dogs jumping.
Wow.
I mean, incredible festivities, all being fueled because up above were these swooping orbs of angelic choirs that were emanating chants, anthems, hymns that would just thunder through my awareness. But it was a sense of awe and majesty and of being in a spiritual home.
Wow.
It's astonishing. Thousands of people wrote to me after reading Proof of Heaven, talking about how my words and my journey awakened in them a memory of something that had been buried deep in their subconscious about their own kind of soul journey.
Yeah.
And that's what I think is so reassuring about all this, is we've all been there. There is this thing called program forgetting, where even though children often will claim memories of past lives, you know, in our culture, that tends to be dismissed.
Mm-hmm.
But for example, at the University of Virginia, scientists have studied claims of past life memories in children over the last 65 years. And in 2,500 cases they've investigated, more than 1,700, they say, are solved. That is, they found the person who lived before. So, but they also warn you, you've got to harvest these memories before age 6 or 7.
Okay.
And so we have a much bigger universe of consciousness to explain to ourselves than just our normal everyday material consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where all of this is really headed. Now, in that beautiful Gateway Valley, the most beautiful thing about it was I wasn't alone.
Okay.
There was a beautiful woman beside me on the butterfly wing, sparkling blue eyes, high forehead, high cheekbones, broad smile. She never said a word to me. She never had to. Her emotional truth was delivered telepathically right into my mental awareness. And I think the message she gave me was the most fundamental message I was to bring back to this world. And when I wrote her the thoughts that came into my awareness, put them into words weeks later, I translated it as, "You are deeply loved and cherished forever. You have nothing to fear. You're richly cared for." And also, as I put it in the book, Proof of Heaven, you can do no wrong.
Yeah.
Now, I wish I had explained that better because I knew where I was in that journey, in that beautiful ambience of love and light and unconditional love and the God force, that the pathway forward is optimal when we treat others with unconditional love, kindness, mercy, respect and acceptance, and when necessary, forgiveness.
Yeah.
And so that's what I meant by "you can do no wrong." Is we know that from the life review, it's basically treat others as you would like to be treated. That's the fundamental lesson. If you hurt another, you're hurting yourself. That's the ultimate part of all of that we come to understand in NDEs. So for me, this beautiful message from this guardian angel was absolutely crucial, but those who've read the book Proof of Heaven will realize that there was much more to that story, especially as I discovered the identity of that beautiful guardian angel 4 months after my coma.
Yeah.
So I won't go into all that right now, but bottom line is, so in this journey, I would ascend. I remember what I sensed is what I call the breath of God or the divine wind blowing through the scene. And even though the elements, as I would describe them, would stay the same, it was a complete awakening in me of that divine force, that God force that is so infinitely loving and so deeply personal.
Yeah.
And that's where the real power of all this comes from, is you come to realize that that God force is never separate from us at all. And in fact, as my journey continued, I remember seeing all of four-dimensional space-time, this material world, collapsing down. And then all of that region of deep time, as I said, where birth, death, everything in between, all of it is simultaneously presented because you're in an eternal realm. All of that was collapsing down. And I then ascended through this light portal that was created by the music of those angelic choirs. And that took me to higher and higher levels, seeing all this collapse down into a complex oversphere as I entered what I call the core. And the core was an infinite inky blackness. It was filled to overflowing with the abundant, healing, unconditional love of that creative God source. Wow. And I came back from it all realizing it doesn't matter if we try and label that force as God, Allah, Brahman, Vishnu, Jehovah, Yahweh, Great Spirit, all the names people use for that force is kind of almost pretending that we can kind of own it and define it, which be further from the truth. I mean, that is the ultimate source of creation. It is absolutely a source of unconditional love of the creator for the creation. And when I witnessed in that core realm how my very conscious awareness was directly sourced in that God force at the core of the universe, I realized that all of us are that deeply connected. We're never separate from that force of infinite, unconditional love, wholeness, and healing.
Wow.
That was a great revelation. And one of the visions I had that really made this all come clear to me was what I call the Indra's Net vision. Mm-hmm. And that was, I would tumble back down from that core realm to the earth for my view. And by remembering the musical notes of the melody, I could conjure up those light portals and ascend back to the Gateway Valley, always welcomed by that beautiful guardian angel. And then the angelic choir has provided yet another portal back into the core. Many lessons to be taught and learned. But in one of those, I had the Ender's Net vision where I saw this interwoven tapestry, really, in a higher dimensional space with these beautiful golden and silvery threads that were all leading towards this golden center of what I think Pierre Teilhard de Chardin would call the Christ consciousness, or the omega point of oneness with that divine creative force. In the Indra's Net vision, it was clear to me how we go through multiple incarnations in the process of growing as souls towards this oneness with the divine. It's all about that healing force of love. And the other thing of importance was this is not like the kind of Buddhist interpretation of reincarnation, where it's basically you're trying to get off the wheel of suffering, because this is a much more grace-filled and kind of God-filled version of progression, transformation, evolution of consciousness itself. As all of us contribute to this evolution. And I'm not sure if you're familiar with Pierre Teilhard de Chardin's book in the mid-20th century. It's called The Phenomenon of Man. But in that book, he makes it clear that there is an evolution going on. At that time, people were discussing Darwinian evolution and biological systems on Earth. But he is a French paleontologist, so a scientist looking at billion-year timescales, and a French Jesuit priest. He had a spiritual awareness, and he recognized that evolution was happening, but it was much grander. It was an evolution of all consciousness throughout the cosmos. And he called it a Christ consciousness, although that doesn't have anything to do really with Christianity as its modern in its modern definition, but something far grander for that Christ consciousness and what it really means.
Wow.
At any rate, so I would cycle back through these levels and ascend back up through these musical portals until finally, as I'd been told, every time I entered the core, you're not here to stay. We'll teach you many things. You'll be going back. Mm-hmm. I'd even come to believe that going back meant back to the earth or my view, which for me was no problem because I'd already learned that by remembering the musical notes of the melody, I could conjure up that light portal and get back up into the spiritual realms. Wow. But there did come a time when they were right. I could no longer do that.
Yeah.
To say I was sad would be an understatement, but I also knew I could trust that I would be taken care of. That's something I'd been promised every time I passed through by that guardian angel and on entering the core by that beautiful God force. And it was then that I saw thousands of beings going off around me into the distance and heads bowed, some holding candles, all this murmuring energy coming from them. And what I called that in my writings weeks later, I said that was the power of prayer.
Wow.
It was drawing me in a direction. I didn't know where,
That's
but
incredible.
It was basically drawing me back to the earthly realm, coming through those lowest spiritual realms. But the thing that was so amazing was it was very comforting.
Yeah.
So the very same comfort that originally I only got in the Gateway Valley and in the core, I was now getting from all these beings around me and this murmuring energy coming from them. And to me, it made sense to explain that as the power of prayer. And then the final thing I saw in my NDE was six faces. that would kind of bubble up out of the muck, say a few words and disappear. I can remember them as sharply visually today as if the whole thing happened yesterday.
Wow.
And the faces that I saw were important because five of them were people who were physically present, friends and family, the last 24 to 48 hours of coma. So essentially, they were showing me the vast majority of the big spiritual journey that seemed to last for months or years, but had to somehow fit somewhere in these 7 days of coma. Mm-hmm. Actually, the main part of the spiritual journey was between days 1 and 4 or 1 and 5 of this long coma. And I talk about the timing of that in the books, mm-hmm. not only Proof of Heaven, but in Living in a Mindful Universe.
Yeah.
But at any rate, it was the last face that really got my attention. That was of a 10-year-old boy. It turned out it was my son, Bond.
Yeah.
My amnesia was still very powerful, so I didn't recognize him as my son.
Wow.
And it turns out it was Sunday morning, day 7 of coma. Hmm. That's when the doctors had, you know, early in the week, they said I had a 10% chance of survival. Later in the week, down to 2% with no chance of recovery. That's when my family knew it was very bad news. They protected Bond, 10 years old, from the worst news during that week. But he overheard that family conference and he knew things were now much worse than he'd been told. Mm-hmm. That's when he came running down the hallway, pulled open my eyelids that were taped shut as I was lying there on my ventilator. And he started pleading with me, Daddy, you're going to be okay. Daddy, you're going to be okay. As if somehow that would make it so. And I promise you, I didn't see him with my eyes or hear him with my ears. I was far too gone from this world.
Yeah.
I mean, when he had pulled my eyelids open, one eye looking over there, one eye over there, neither pupil working. Anybody in medicine knows that's a horrible picture. But at any rate, it got through to me. And even though because of my amnesia, this whole journey had happened in a setting of my mm-hmm. believing, well, this can continue or cease, doesn't matter. Now, all of a sudden, everything mattered because there was another soul out there who needed me.
Mm-hmm.
And just like so many NDEers come back to this world out of a sense of responsibility for another soul, that's basically what drove me back to this world. And I have no idea. I don't feel like I willfully made it happen,
yeah.
but and yet my higher soul must have contributed to my coming back to this world. And not only that, ended up making a full recovery. When I first woke up in the ICU bed and was fighting the ventilator and they pulled out the breathing tube, I said, thank you. But I still didn't recognize people around me, like my mother, my sisters, my sons. I had no idea who these beings were. And my youngest sister, Phyllis, tells a kind of a funny story. She'd been there most of that week. And of course, they'd been laying the black crepe, this horrible scenario, doctors with, you know, without any real hope of an expectation of recovery. That's what the family was dealing with. And so then within half an hour or so of coming out of coma, even though my brain was still very savaged by the illness, and I'd be in and out of a paranoid, delusional, psychotic nightmare for 36 hours after awakening from coma. But my sister said I was sitting there on the bed mm-hmm. after all these dire warnings, and I would look at each person in the eye, you know, doctors, nurses, family, friends, and I'd look them in the eye and I'd say, don't worry. All is well.
Wow, stop it.
And then I move to the next one. Don't worry.
Oh my gosh.
All is well.
Wow.
With this great reassurance.
Yes.
Wow.
And, you know, I know where it came from now. It came because the only thing I remembered when I woke up was the deep coma journey. I still had no memories of Evan Alexander's life. That stuff came back like a gently falling snow over about 2 months. I mean, the personal memories and language came back very quickly.
Okay.
But a lot of my semantic knowledge, like cosmology, physics, neuroscience, took up to 2 months to return. And in fact, based on detailed conversations with family and friends about early childhood events, I realized that after the coma, the memories were more complete than they had been before the coma. So we talk about all that in our third book, Living in a Mindful Universe, how memories are not even stored in the brain.
Wow.
It's probably one of the last nails in the coffin of materialist neuroscience.
Wow.
So it took about 2 months for my neuroscience knowledge to come back. During that time, I was going to the hospital, reviewing medical records, talking over with my doctors, looking at CT and MRI scans, especially neurologic exams. Those are the most important ways to track somebody in coma. My Glasgow coma scale of 5, 6, or 7, anything below 9 is deep coma.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, it's an extraordinary experience that has led to now my 16 years of collaboration
yeah.
with other scientists around the world, I hadn't realized before how many scientists were interested in consciousness in this big way that, that takes them far beyond materialism, because materialism fails. There's no way that any model of brain creates consciousness has ever worked at all. And it's because the brain is more of a transceiver of filter. And that's why these stories of people who are coming close to death are actually of an expansion of conscious awareness. And for those who say, well, wait a minute, I want to hear what happens when you die, not just when you almost die, it turns out that the hospice and palliative care literature fully supports the reality of NDEs. There's a beautiful book by Christopher Kerr. He's head of Hospice Buffalo. He's an MD who's written extensively about terminal care and what happens when people die. And just as in NDEs, the, one of the most common things you have happen is loved ones who have departed come back to welcome you across. And they do it in an alive, present fashion. This is not official thinking or vague memory of who they were. It's a powerful recognition of the ongoing reality of connectedness of our souls. And this, of course, is where we like to go, not just in Proof of Heaven, but in Living in a Mindful Universe. That book goes a long way towards making the case for the scientific reality of the afterlife and of reincarnation. We just have, our souls are much bigger than we ever would have thought before, at least from that kind of materialistic perspective. They're much grander. And essentially, the model we're coming up with in modern kind of neuroscience and philosophy of mind is one where there's a primordial mind, and everything emerges from that. That includes the entire physical universe emerges from that primordial mind. But each and every one of us as a sentient being has access to that that beautiful one mind, that God mind, that is one of pure love and connection, kindness and mercy. And that's why these deep lessons of, you know, treat others as you would like to be treated, or the golden rule, is such a clear part of life reviews.
Love thy neighbor.
Study them scientifically, you find, I'll just mention two little facts about them, and then we can move on to any questions or answers you go to. But life reviews studied in large numbers, like Bruce Grayson wrote a report of almost 700 life reviews. It came out in the fall of 2021 in the Journal of Near-Death Studies. And for one thing, he points out a third of people report that the life review is complete. Their entire life flashes before their eyes. And you might wonder, how does that happen during a 10-minute cardiac arrest and an NDE, for example? And it happens because that realm is absolutely timeless. And that's a very critical thing to get, because it has everything to do also with people's fear. Sometimes they hear about reincarnation. They say, oh, wait a minute. What if my loved one reincarnates before I pass over? I want them to welcome me. Well, the reality is there is so much love and connection and relationship that comes out of these stories empirically that there's absolutely no way, especially when you recognize the timelessness of that spiritual realm, that you would be cheated out of having a loved one be there for you at the time of your passage because they've, quote, already reincarnated. That doesn't happen. There's far too much of the way of love and connection and kindness and mercy, and that we're here for each other to allow for a loved one to have reincarnated, quote, before you get there. So that's a very important point. The other key thing to point to make about life reviews is that something like three quarters of the life reviews in Bruce Grayson's series said it was that events were relived from the perspective of everyone involved. So in other words, if you've been handing out pain and suffering to others, in your life review, you get on the receiving end of that, and it doesn't feel good. And so ultimately, life reviews are nudging us towards the golden rule, towards treating each other with that respect and dignity of sacred divine beings that we all truly are. And this also means taking care of the least, the last, and the lost, you know, in this day and time, sadly, with war and conflict and refugees and all that, it means we need to take care of people who are much less fortunate and who have been kind of cursed by various world events. We're here to show love and compassion and kindness. And that really is the deepest lesson of the NDE community. And now that the scientific community is getting on board in supporting the reality of these kind of journeys, I think a big wake-up call is in order for the world at large. And it's one that is long overdue. And, you know, we've had 5,000 years for religious systems to teach us the golden rule. So maybe now the science of consciousness, through the lens of near-death experiences and other similar extraordinary experiences, will help us get to that point of truly learning this beautiful lesson of connection and love.
Beautiful.
Yeah. So, like,
we have a million questions. Yeah. Now,
we read a book by John Burke, and his book, he talks about Dr. Mary Neal. There's a kid, and also a 4-year-old. I think his name was Colton Burpo. You know, these people are seeing like actual Jesus, and you know, we're Catholic, so we look at things like reincarnation a bit differently.
And I'm sure you come across that where people are like,
you must get that all the time.
Against my, you know, or like, what are you talking about? And it's nothing against what you experienced or like doubting that. Right. It's just kind of like it's just obviously everybody has their views on what it is. And it's just listening to it and then hearing these stories of them meeting Jesus.
They actually meet Jesus, and you know, your experience is a lot different. Like, what do you say to, I know you kind of touched on it about ideologies, but what do you say to Christians that are like, whoa, I don't know about that one? And
first of all, remember that Jesus knew fully well about the reality of reincarnation. Mm-hmm. He knew that John the Baptist was reincarnated from an earlier prophet. And so in those days, and to Jesus Christ, Jesus of Nazareth, reincarnation was part of life. It was accepted and known. Now, it turns out, though, that at the Council of Nicaea, Constantine, you know, the Romans realized now 2 centuries into Christianity that it wasn't going to die and go away.
Yeah.
And they were amazed that Christianity had this incredible staying power. And so during the Council of Nicaea, they were trying to codify Christianity. And Constantine in particular realized that any talk of reincarnation potentially took the power away from the church and the priest and put that power in the hands of the individual soul.
Mm.
And they said, wait a minute, this is going to terribly interfere with our ability to control people through Christianity and through a religious ideology. Mm. So Constantine made any talk of reincarnation punishable by inverted crucifixion.
Mm.
It was the most cruel form of execution that he knew of. And he didn't want this talk of reincarnation, which was very commonly known back in Jesus's time. He wanted to prevent that from moving forward to enhance the Roman, Roman influence on Christianity. So don't think that reincarnation is forbidden from the viewpoint of Jesus of Nazareth. It's not at all. And that's an important thing to get. The other thing is I really didn't know about the scientific literature on reincarnation before my coma.
Yeah.
And I only learned about it after that. And specifically, if you go to uvadops.org, the University of Virginia Division of Perceptual Studies, you'll find a website devoted to all their academic publications, books, et cetera. They've done tremendous work in this field. And as I said, in 2,500 cases of past life memories in children that they've investigated over 65 years, 1,700 they actually found the person who lived before.
Wow.
So you can say, well, I don't remember past lives. And that's perfectly fair because most of us don't. And Jim Tucker and Ian Stevenson, the doctors who have done most of that research, will tell you, you have to harvest these memories before age 6 or 7, because after that, they're covered over and people don't remember past lives very well. The memories can come up in an NDE. They can come up in meditation. They can come up in hypnosis. So there are ways that those memories can be recovered. They can come up in dreams.
Yeah.
There's a reason, I believe, that we have this, what I call programmed forgetting.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, we come in as young children, we might have memories of past lives and between lives, but for whatever reason, at the current level of human development, we're supposed to forget that stuff to live these lives. And for us, it gives us skin in the game.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, you know, if you say, well, I don't believe in reincarnation, you're fighting a mountain of data in the scientific community that says reincarnation has happened, you know, thousands of times that we can document. And I'm not putting it to me as a Christian, you know, it doesn't alter things at all because it's still all about love, kindness, compassion, mercy, taking care of each other, unconditional love.
Yeah.
That is big message from NDE. There's a lovely book by a friend of mine, Robert Coppes, C-O-P-P-E-S, where he's very knowledgeable about NDEs. And his book is called The Essence of Religions. And what he basically does is he takes the three Abrahamic faiths, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, and Hinduism and Buddhism, and he compares them with the lessons of NDEs. And NDEs he views as kind of the gold standard. They're the ultimate optimal presentation of this kind of knowledge and information to human beings. And then he looks at how the various religions have come close to that gold standard of NDEs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, certainly Christianity is a very powerful and much aligned way of thinking about this. Mm-hmm. Once you realize it's all about love and also an acknowledgement that it's not just saying that you believe in Christ, mm-hmm. That ultimately you need to act, emulate as Christ did.
Yeah.
And that's more of the deep lesson. And to me, this doesn't really contradict Christianity at all.
Yeah.
You can argue that it contradicts, you know, our modern interpretation of Christianity and the Council of Nicaea and Constantine's influence, but mm-hmm. it doesn't violate one bit the teachings of Jesus of Nazareth. And that's what I think is so important to point out here. And to me, the whole thing folds beautifully into everything I was taught growing up in a Methodist and then an Episcopal church.
Okay.
And that is, you know, accepting in the obvious fact that Christ knew that John the Baptist was a reincarnated prophet. So reincarnation is not a violation of anything that Jesus of Nazareth thought. So we can just move forward with a full acceptance of this scientific support of the reality of our soul. Mm. That's basically what reincarnation and NDEs and all of these stories, after-death communications, the hospice literature, every bit of it fully supports a loving Christ. Mm-hmm. But it also tells us that it's emulating the love of Christ that makes a difference. For example, I have a very close friend, Anita Morjani, who had an NDE. She's Hindu. Mm. She had a loving, beautiful, loving experience and was cured of her lymphoma.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, some of my, some people in my audiences would say, well, wait a minute, you know, she didn't believe in Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. So how does that happen? Well, it happens because it's by following the love. The connection of love, kindness, compassion. That's the ultimate message Christ was giving us.
Yeah.
Not stomping around saying, you got to believe in me if you want to get to heaven. That came from people later trying to kind of codify Christianity in certain ways. I will tell you that for me, I've gained some insight from reading beyond the typical biblical references, going to some of the apocryphal texts, like the Book of Thomas. I've read some of Elaine Pagel's work that mm-hmm. to me kind of opened my mind to a bigger interpretation of Christianity than what has been handed down to us by the modern church. But don't believe for one second that the deep, profound message of love coming out of NDEs violates anything whatsoever taught by Jesus of Nazareth.
Yeah.
Because that is just not the case.
Interesting.
Well, I kind of want to go back to when you first got into your coma in your house, or you just started having your seizures. I'm very curious about that. You said there's no time. There's no time up there, but you said you were in a coma for 7 days. So again, it's like, was it like 7 days for you? Did it feel like 7 days? Or is it like, this is 5 minutes in a 7 day? Like, I know time here and there is.
What it felt like was months or years.
Really?
But of course, well, you got to remember that I was essentially starting over at zero.
Wow.
You know, by having no memory, no past.
Okay, that's right. Okay.
Everything was in the moment. And, you know, so I was living an eternity in every moment.
Interesting.
But I had no past to refer back to because of the amnesia. So it was an extraordinary kind of unfolding. But when I, if you would ask me when I first woke up and they took out the breathing tube and I said, thank you.
Yeah.
I'm sitting there telling everybody, don't worry, all is well. If you would ask me then how long I'd been gone, For one thing, I would have been confused because I wouldn't even realize what you meant by gone. Mm-hmm. But I would know you were referring back to what I had just experienced, mm-hmm. you know, this spiritual journey in coma. And I would have told you months or years. It was a very long, detailed, incredibly rich and kind of convoluted and involuted self-referential system of examination and multiple passages through all those layers that I talked about. So it was a very long experience, and yet it had to happen in 7 Earth Days. But remember, as Bruce Grayson tells us in Scientific Study of Life Reviews, a third of people say it involves your entire life without exception.
Wow.
So how does that happen in a short period of Earth time? Well, it's because that realm is completely beyond Earth time. In fact, our flow of Earth time in many ways is kind of an illusion introduced by consciousness itself.
And they say too, and we've read a whole bunch of different people's near-death experiences, a lot of it, and you've alluded to this, you can't describe what you see. There's nothing in this world that could ever describe. You hear a lot about
colors,
the sounds. I mean, again, we're just so small here compared to what's awaiting us, and to even try to articulate it here in this world is, you just can't, like you said, it's like, it's not like Disneyland.
It's ineffable.
Yeah.
But you know, it's. I think it's important to point out that it's. I look at that world, especially that kind of middle level, the Gateway Valley.
Yeah.
Is very much like Plato's world of ideals. Mm-hmm. You know, if you study the ancient Greek philosopher Plato, who was writing in like 300 BC, you'll find he has this allegory of the cave. Where everybody is watching shadows on a cave wall coming from a fire, but they're seeing shadows of events that are occurring out in reality. But they're only seeing the shadows. And so what Plato was arguing is that there's a world of ideals, a world of form. And I would say that in many ways, that's what this Gateway Valley was. It was a world of ideals. And so people often ask me, well, can you remember the music? You know, I often talk about the music that I used as kind of associated with these light portals that took me between spiritual levels. And no, I can remember the quality of it, but it's a music that you could never have in our four-dimensional space-time. The physics of this world only allows certain vibratory modes and kind of experiences of sound and music. But in that world, it's the ideal.
Yeah.
I think that is the world that composers, for example, musicians, you know, in their meditative states and their dreams, when they're going for a new riff or a new kind of musical, you know, kind of a musical pathway or what have you, that they're basically getting into this world of ideals. So it's kind of a world that's open to all of us. And this is why I recommend meditation, centering prayer, going within. Once you realize that your mind is not simply, you know, the result of chemical reactions and electron fluxes in a 3.5-pound gelatinous mass floating inside your skull, but you're sharing the mind of the universe, that's when things start to get much more interesting. And you realize, well, maybe meditation and centering prayer would be of some interest. Maybe there's more going on there than I think. And what I can tell you is, yes, that's the case. And I realized within the first 2 years after my coma, I'd read 150 books, you know, quantum physics, spiritual traditions, East and West, trying to get a deeper understanding. And I realized, no, the only way you're going to have a deeper understanding is exploring your own consciousness. I knew I had to get into meditation. At the time, I had just read an article in Scientific American, I think it was September or October of 74, by Gerald Oster. It's called Binaural Beats in the Brain. Mm-hmm. And it's all about the circuits in the lower brainstem that are used by groups like Sacred Acoustics. If you go to sacredacoustics.com, you can learn a lot more. But the reality is that oscillating circuit in the lower brainstem is kind of the magic that allows your consciousness to break free of the illusion of here, now, and sense of self. And I've learned to just ride those tones of the Sacred Acoustics audio files that causes powerful oscillation way down in my lower brainstem. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you think about it, hypnosis has used oscillations in the brainstem for ages, to, you know, like a pendulum, and your eyes moving to watch the pendulum, that is causing an oscillation down in the midbrain. And it turns out with sacred acoustics and other binaural beat brainwave entrainment, you're actually just going to a much more primitive level, which means you're getting a much more powerful effect with these oscillations. You're way down in the medulla, which is the lowest part of the brainstem with the superior olivary nucleus. That's where the sacred acoustics tones are causing this oscillation. And what you find, I mean, it doesn't work for everybody, but it certainly works for a lot of people. If you read the testimonials at sacredacoustics.com, you'll find a lot of people getting tremendous benefit. It's what you're trying to do is get into a hypnagogic space, that is between awake and asleep. So you're at a space where you're no longer bothered by that monkey mind, the little voice in your head. And that's something that I've learned to easily tune out, you know, using sacred acoustics tones just by writing those tones. Wow. But they're a very powerful way of getting into a deep hypnagogic space. And that's where we can get creative. That's where the universe really offers up a tremendous amount of information. And so often in a meditation, my little ego linguistic voice might state a request, you know, put out a question, what have you. But then I've learned to ride those tones of sacred acoustics, get into a very deep space between awake and asleep, where the universe can then offer me answers and observations that contribute to my understanding. Wow. It's a very different process compared to, you know, when we think our way to an answer, when we follow the breadcrumbs of logic and rational thinking. This is a way of opening up to the universe and saying, I want to answer to some really big, tough questions. What seed material will you give me to help in my understanding? And that's where this kind of meditation can be very helpful. I've used it, sacred acoustics, an hour to a day for the last 11, 12 years, something like that. A very powerful technique for returning to my NDE, recovering many of the kind of lessons, but also cultivating a relationship with, for example, that beautiful guardian angel. And I describe in Living in a Mindful Universe how I finally encountered my adoptive father's soul. My adoptive father was very important in all this, a globally renowned neurosurgeon. He had passed over 4 years before my coma. And he was nowhere to be seen in my near-death experience. But when he appeared to me in meditation 2.5 years after the coma, he said the reason he could not be apparent to me during that NDE was because I would have tended to dismiss it. You know, in spite of the 1 in 10 million diagnosis of E. coli meningitis in an adult, in spite of 1 in a billion recovery, if I'd seen who I wanted to see first and foremost, I would have said, oh, yeah, you just see who you want to see on your way out. I guess it's a wishful thinking, a hallucination. Yeah. That's why the universe took me much deeper and showed me a guardian angel who I'd never met in my life, but she was very important to me. And that had to do with my adoption history, my birth family.
Wow. So I was going to ask you about that as well, but before I forget,
I have a question too.
I'm wondering, like, because I thought about, I have listened to binaural beats, like I mentioned before. I'm like, do you ever worry that, because I've had some negative experiences in the past, like maybe a little supernatural, but have you ever been worried that you could be allowing some kind of negative something, you know, coming into that space that you're that frequency?
I'll tell you why and how. For one thing, I was blessed to have this NDE, you know, before I ever started doing all this, you know, by meditation, prayer, et cetera. And that NDE showed me very clearly that there is an ultimate power in the universe, that God force is not confronted, you know, at the deepest levels in the core realm. That God force of pure love was absolutely undiluted. There is no competition for that. So in other words, yes, the earthworm eye view, there are some kind of primitive levels we go through in the spiritual realms in getting there. But when you know in your heart that that God force is with you and is you, you have absolutely nothing to fear. And yes, there can be negative entities that you encounter. In many ways, I love how, for example, in some of the literature on Tibetan dream work, they talk about how some of those demons that you initially kind of encounter, you know, maybe in meditation or in a near-death experience, what have you, how there are various kind of aspects of your soul, and they're only there to help you. Even though they can appear evil, they can appear kind of diabolical, but they're only there to help kind of nudge you towards that greater realization of the infinite power and love you have by being a creation of that God force. So you never have anything to fear, even though you might encounter, ultimately, your ace is knowing that your soul and your experience is completely rooted in a force that is completely and absolutely benevolent and loving and supporting your highest and best dreams and aspirations.
Interesting.
So you don't have to worry about any of the apparent darkness that you might encounter.
So you're not, so to be, just to be clear, you're not worried about, like, so do you believe in the devil, like as the supreme dark energy?
I do not, because I think this is borne out by near-death experiences. And in fact, it's kind of shocking when you study them, in our very materialist, egocentric, narcissistic culture, how willing souls are to let go of this world to embrace and bathe in that beautiful world. And yet, as we just said a little while ago, souls often come back to this world to help other souls. Now, what I realized in my journey is that this is where we get the work done. This life, temporarily blinded to what our higher soul knows about the bigger aspects of our eternal existence. But this is where we get the work done. Mm-hmm. You know, life reviews and between lives is only kind of a course correction. That's an ability to maybe get as much progress out of this recent lifetime as possible before we dive into the next one. Important to get that this life is important. That's why, murder and suicide in many ways are violations of this kind of natural order that allows for people to live their lives out. And there are lessons that are learned through those hardships and difficulties, but ultimately this is all about nudging us towards this oneness with the divine that doesn't involve any kind of eternal hell or damnation. Mm. To me, the apparent evils, the apparent darkness that we see in the human condition are all things that only emerge way out here near the periphery. But as you're getting deeper and deeper to that core, it's all oneness and love and kindness, compassion and mercy without exception. Yeah. So you really have nothing to fear in these kind of journeys. In fact, I came back realizing, for example, that some who I had seen before my coma as a nemesis, as my enemy, as someone who is preventing me from getting something in life, my coma journey showed me very clearly that we were simply near and dear soul mates, and that we were trying to teach each other especially difficult and challenging lessons. And that's what made us appear to be so much at odds. Mm. And yet I came away realizing the value of that statement I made 20 minutes after waking up from coma: all is well. Mm-hmm. You know, that acknowledgement that when you have this big, 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 much bigger perspective of all that's happening, you recognize it's all for your good. It's all for you to grow and learn from and teach and to help in the evolution of consciousness itself. Mm-hmm. So I've come to embrace the hardships, embrace the apparent darknesses and evils, but doing that from a position of authenticity in my heart, mm-hmm. knowing that ultimately that my very awareness and existence is rooted in an infinitely loving God force. A pure, unconditional love, kindness, and compassion. And my duty as, as a soul waking up to all this is to do my best to bring as much love, compassion, and kindness from that realm into this realm as I can mm-hmm. through my thoughts and actions. And that's, again, why I encourage people to meditate, go within. You'll start finding this very beautiful, peaceful core that is there for all of us. The ego, remember, if the ego's in charge, ego has fear and anxiety. All addictions are basically ego diseases.
Yeah.
Your ego is not your ally in this.
Yeah.
So letting go of the ego and kind of embracing the higher good and taking care of others, showing love, compassion, and kindness, even in the face of adversity and apparent darkness. But the more we can demonstrate this evil and its power to bring wholeness and healing, the better for all involved.
Yeah.
And it's not as if you need 100% of the population to be meditating or praying to get this, I mean, in some communities, they've shown simply by getting up to 3% of the community meditating, you get a significant decrease in the amount of violent crime and conflict in that community. So, you know, just a few of us meditating and trying to bring peace and love and compassion and kindness and harmony to this world mm-hmm. can do a world of good for the rest of us at large.
Amen.
But ultimately, these are lessons for all of us to embrace and kind of learn from. And they can be very a cause for optimism and hope in this world that otherwise, you know, these days, reading the headlines, things look a little tough and dire and kind of conflicted and fractious. And yet the reality is we all have the power, certainly within ourselves, to come to this deep harmonious center of peace and love, and then to start bringing that into our lives and into the world at large.
Wow. Well, I know we don't have much time with you. I do have two questions to end. Is that okay, babe?
I had one.
Oh,
can
I
you
have
do
two.
One, I do one?
No, you've asked
time.
One.
You got time.
Okay, good. Well, I mean, we've read a lot, and there I've watched, I remember I watched a young man, I don't know if he was on Oprah or he was on somebody else's show. He talked about his near-death experience, but he went down. So I've read some too, where they do experience this terror of like, maybe they were in a gang, or maybe they were, their lives were not where they should be here in this world. And they went and they came back. I think he was shot or something in a gang violent type of scenario. Mm-hmm. And it was like scared straight. I mean, he was brought down to this terror and pain, and he felt that, like you said, the what he afflicted on other people, and he had to feel it internally. So I know, though, I have read those as well, where it's almost like God shows them, even though you say there's no hell, that okay, you're not in a good, this is not what I want of you, this is kind of the pain you're causing
right
in this world. And then the second question I'm gonna ask.
Okay. Can I just that for just a second here? Remember that the life review, if you're standing out a lot of pain and suffering to other people, that you have to experience that on the receiving end during the life review. That's why it's the golden rule written into the fabric of the universe. Treat others as you would like to be treated.
Yeah.
And in fact, my notion, I think our concepts of hell come directly from life reviews of people who have mistreated others so extensively that when they feel that in their life review, it's just really, you know, impactful, and it changes them.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing to point out is the negative or hellish near-death experiences that you're talking about.
Yeah.
And they're probably around 3-5% of all the reports, maybe a little bit more. And I would also say they're probably even less well-reported than the positive NDEs.
Yeah.
Positive NDEs, people often won't talk about them because they're so strange, and in our culture, that's not accepted. And yet they can be very comforting. Mm-hmm. The negative NDEs, it turns out, also have very positive transformative changes.
Yeah, of course.
You know, people come back from that hellish experience, and they realize that mistreating others was a bad, bad, bad plan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they change. They start treating others with respect and love.
Yeah.
So if it accomplishes the same beautiful transformation of bringing love, peace, and harmony into the lives of sentient beings in this world, even though they have to realize that their previous behaviors were a major violation of some of these deep principles of oneness and love, then that's just the way the world moves forward.
Yeah.
But the hellish ones, interestingly enough, have often the very same positive transformational effects as the very positive NDEs, which are the majority of them.
Interesting.
So, but to me, it makes zero sense to ever postulate that there is some eternal damnation and hell going on anywhere in this universe. It just doesn't make sense. And it's not what you encounter. I mean, even if you go to, say, hospice in prisons, in maximum security prisons that are filled with rapists and murderers, and you're dealing with prisoners there serving as hospice for their fellow prisoners, what you find is they're often going for redemption. They're realizing the errors of their ways, making amends for the people they hurt with this deep sense of love and connection and kindness. And that's what they're doing right when they die. They're making amends and acknowledging that behavior was antithetical to who they are as a soul.
Okay.
And so that's why I think it's important to kind of look at all of this and the bigger picture that it's presenting to us. And that is really one of a universe that ultimately is based and grounded and created mm-hmm. in this unconditional loving force. I often call it the love of the creator for the creation. Yeah. But the reality is we're all co-creating our emerging reality with that God force. So we're never separate from it at all.
Wow. Yeah, well, my last question.
No. Oh, I had two. I want to do okay, now. I'm sorry. We're husband and wife.
No fighting.
No. Good. Just real quick before I forget. Why do some people experience near-death experiences and some don't? Like, there's been plenty of people who have almost died, who have been in a coma, and there's nothing. Mm. It's just, I don't remember. Yeah. They wake up, and then it makes us say, like, wait a minute, is this real? Does this really happen?
All
Why
I
didn't
you
do it? And are you afraid to die again? Are you afraid?
Well, no, I'm not afraid.
You're
not afraid at all.
Okay,
I'm in a hurry because I think I have more to do in this lifetime in this body.
Yeah.
But when it happens, I know it'll be a tremendous adventure.
Yeah.
I know it's... expansion.
You've been there before.
And also a tremendous expansion of connection with loved ones.
Yeah.
Both still alive and past.
Okay.
So no, it's nothing to be afraid of. It's an adventure. But again, I don't want people, you know, to commit suicide or something.
Oh, no.
World.
Yeah.
Well, people do that, sadly. They hear NDE stories and they commit suicide. And it's important to get, your issues will be repackaged for the next incarnation. You never dodge any issues by committing suicide.
Yeah.
And that's a very important thing to get out there to people.
100%.
Because I'm aware of cases where people committed suicide after reading NDE literature. So that's to be shied away from.
I didn't even think about that. Yeah, that's okay.
Well, the good news is, when people hear the big story, they realize we're here to become closer to that God force over multiple lifetimes. But suicide and homicide are direct violations of pretty much all the rules of that realm.
Fascinating.
That kind of is it. I can piggyback off with my question that I wondered, like, because there was a case, we were watching a documentary and the guy was so depressed after his experience, like he wanted to go back so well. I'm like, did you ever experience that kind of feeling like, man,
I don't want to be here.
I don't want to be here, man. I want to go back
home, basically. You know, he called it home.
Well, did you go through a long period of that?
I actually kind of solved that by getting into meditation. Mm. So in deep meditation, I've spent a lot of time kind of intersecting and interacting with the spiritual guides that I've met in the Gateway Valley and in the core realm initially.
Yeah.
So I use meditation to return to it. And and that's why I also encourage people to use meditation because to know of this literature is very important. Just to know about NDEs, Ken Ring, who was one of the founders of the International Association of Near-Death Studies, back in the mid-1970s, he wrote a book of maybe 35 years ago that talked about how just knowing about NDEs and knowing about these kinds of cases is enough to give people the same benefits that the NDEer gets from having the experience. Yeah. So that's why sharing these stories, I encourage whenever people come up and share stories with me, and one of the blessings of my going public with my own story is that thousands of people have come up to me and shared their story by email, at meetings, what have you. They've shared their story with me. And that has been very affirming and validating in kind of my understanding. But important to get that sharing these stories, knowing about this, especially if you then take on your own program of meditation, centering prayer, going within. And especially important is to turn off a little ego voice.
Yeah.
Because if you're just lying there with a monkey mind in your head, complaining that you're not doing it right, and the ego uses fear and anxiety as its main tools, that's not going to help you. But that's why a good form of meditation allows you to get deeply into that hypnagogic space between awake and asleep. And that's where, to me, that's where the real power is.
Wow.
And that's why I strongly encourage people to meditate and use centering prayer.
Wow.
That's amazing.
Well, that's amazing, though.
We could have you on for 10 hours. I mean, we could just sit here and talk.
Yeah, we definitely value your time, man.
Yeah.
It's been a real pleasure.
My pleasure. Yeah. And you all have hit on some high points here. There's one resource I will also put out there for your listeners. And this is, you know, in addition to our book, Living in a Mindful Universe, there's a workbook that goes along with that that's free. And you can get started today because it's online. If you go to ebenalexander.com, that's ebenalexander.com, you see a little 33-day journey into the heart of consciousness, kind of wagging in your face on the entry page there. Okay. And if you just click on that, leave your first name and email address, the next 33 days, you're off and running. You'll get an email each day on a major concept from that book.
Okay.
And then there are more than 12,000 people who have taken that course over the last few years. They've formed a community of comments, and they're helping each other. All that stuff is there apparent if you do that 33-day journey. So that's an easy way to get into all this right now and for free. And the other thing I'll mention is BigelowInstitute.org. That's a website that has 29 scientific essays proving the reality of conscious awareness after permanent bodily death. Hmm. That is scientifically proving the reality of the afterlife. A lot of them touch on the reality of God, on reincarnation, things like that. But it's all about a bigger scientific understanding of the nature of consciousness, which is cause for great celebration because... this is all about coming to understand ourselves and each other and our reasons for being much more fully. And that's where the world can really open up and become very satisfying.
Beautiful. Wow. Evan, that's amazing.
Really fascinating stuff.
We'll put that all into the end here too. We'll put that in. And we really want people to read your book. I mean, we've actually lent it out to a couple people just so they can in the family as well, but we would love to have you back on at another time.
Sure, we should do that.
Yeah,
we
would love
to do that. One other thing to mention is even if people read the book long ago, the versions that are out now, Proof of Heaven, are the 10th anniversary edition.
Oh, lovely.
It has 36 pages beyond the original book. So
this is the one, right?
Do we have the right one?
Yeah, that's the 10th.
It should say 10th anniversary edition on the cover.
Let's see.
Yeah, 10th anniversary.
Oh, it's right there in big print in front of me.
Good.
Okay.
And also especially important there is the new foreword. There's a 6-page foreword, and that really covers a lot of what's happened in the last decade. So
perfect.
That's awesome.
This is amazing.
Part of it all.
Well, we appreciate your time, and thank you, and keep doing what you're doing.
Yeah, that was fascinating. It's a real pleasure to speak with you after, you know, years of checking out your stuff.
Yeah.
Well, great. Well, so good speaking with you all. And maybe to spice it up, if we were to talk again, you can arrange all that to Elizabeth, but to spice it up, we should have my wife and partner and co-author of Living in Mindful Universe, Karen Newell, who is a spiritual mentor. She's incredibly knowledgeable about sound and meditation and spiritual issues of all scales. So to have Karen on would really bring some spice into it all.
Yeah, oh, awesome. I'd love to meet her. Yes.
But it's great talking with you
both.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me on. Thanks for doing what you do to get it out there.
Absolutely. And we'll send you this.
Absolutely. Yeah. God bless you.
Have a good one.
God bless you too. Talk soon.
Talk to you later.
Bye-bye.